Hello and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mark Christensen and I'm joined by Mike Seymour. Hello, Mike.
Hey, Mark. How are you?
Doing just fine. How are you?
Look, I'm doing particularly well today, actually. Just restrung my guitar and I'm a happy camper.
How long had it been?
It's been a while. You know, it's been a while since my last string. Hi, my name's Mike, and I've been using my guitar without restringing it lately. You know, the thing is, I can't play guitar very well, right? So I should preface that. I'm far more at the beginner end than the expert end, but I have fun.
Good. Well, without further ado, this week's episode is a slight departure from what we normally do on this show, which is to review movies and visual effects in movies. This week, we've decided to focus on a trend, and the name of that trend is outsourcing, although there are alternate titles we could use for this show. Offshoring is a hot topic, as is overhead. So words that begin with O, but outsourcing is actually particularly apt. It's something that's been going on in the industry for a long time, and it's a topic about which we want to be particularly sensitive because it stirs up all kinds of feelings. Part of what inspired this was some reactions we got to our show on The Golden Compass, and something notable about that film, especially winning the Academy Award, was that a significant chunk of it was actually done at Rhythm and Hues in Mumbai. Now, Mike, you've been on the front lines of quite a few operations around the world, isn't that right?
Yeah, and I've also visited China and India and looked at places in both of those locations. Though I don't pretend to be an expert on outsourcing, but you know, we established on this show we don't have to be an expert to have an opinion.
Well, and this is a fast-moving topic about which even so-called experts in other fields will stir up a lot of controversy and contradictory feelings. Witness Thomas Friedman's book, The World is Flat, and some of the reactions that he got to that. So in a sense, we're all blind men feeling around our part of the elephant. However, there are some things we can say with some certainty. One of them is that outsourcing has actually been part of VFX for quite a long time. I was thinking about it. I'm in the Bay Area, and I've done quite a bit of work over the years with The Orphanage, which is a studio that actually began as an outsourcing operation from ILM before they went on to do some independent filmmaking and then swing back into being a major visual effects operation. But here in the Bay Area, you know, I was thinking about it, and the only company that doesn't actually trace its lineage back to Lucasfilm, the only big one until recently, was PDI.
That's true, actually, yeah. I remember actually talking to the PDI guys way back in the day. I mean, I'm talking like, God, that'd have been like 20 years ago. Yeah. And they were some of the first to adopt workstations. And yeah, PDI did amazing work back then, and then, of course, became part of DreamWorks.
Right. But is this a trend you've seen in other major capitals? It's worth pointing out that, you know, visual effects, as we all know, seems to cluster around the world's most expensive cities. Not all of them, and yet the places where visual effects is really happening, at least the large shops by and large, seem to be in, they happen to coincide with some of the highest overhead locations in the world. Isn't that right?
I guess, actually, it's an interesting point. I hadn't thought of that before. Why do you say that? Because, I mean, obviously there's the LA thing, which bings to San Francisco, but, I mean, you don't really know Tokyo or Paris as being major centers. I think you have any major city that's the sort of, I don't know, resource slash, you know, capital for talent in that country. Do you know what I mean? Like, I wonder if it's Paris because it's expensive real estate, or Paris because that's the hub of French kind of, you know, intellectual labor that would be appropriate for doing this kind of work.
Well, it's a question worth asking. I mean, again, I can refer most intelligently about my local market, and other industries in Silicon Valley have outsourced just to Sacramento, which is the next nearest urban center that's got quite a bit lower overhead. So, for example, Intel has a big operation there. But I can't imagine that happening with visual effects. And by the way, we are talking this week predominantly about visual effects work, i.e. post-production on major feature films. However, I imagine we'll also touch on animation. There's also the live action portion, the actual stages on which people shoot. And of course, there's the computer games industry, which along with animation has been sending work here, there, and everywhere for quite some time.
I guess from my point of view, I have absolutely 180 degrees two opinions that are at contrary to each other on this, right? Firstly, I have enormous sympathy for anyone that loses their job because their position moves offshore into an environment that they themselves can't compete with. You know, if it moves to another company, well, then that's the ebb and flow of business, right? If it moves to another country, then, you know, upping and going and moving to that other country isn't normally a viable option. Doesn't matter what industry you're in, right? So that idea of it moving offshore is, I have enormous sympathy for anyone facing that. Okay, so that's position to the left. My right position is to say, well, is it offshoring, outsourcing just when it goes to a country you don't like? I mean, at what point does it I understand completely, but I mean, I don't understand at one level why it should be any surprise that a global market, a globalization results in things being done globally. And you know, that's what happens, right? I mean, it's the nature of economic development. And so is it really a surprise that people are starting to do more work in faraway countries? Well, no, because that's what happens. They've done it in every other industry.
Indeed. And in fact, you could even argue that this industry is a bit slower than many others to adopt to it. And there may be strong reasons for that, which I think we'll get to. You know, going back to my point about expensive cities and high overhead. One thing a lot of people don't realize, particularly about visual effects, is it's a fairly low margin business overall. Sure, there's a lot of money in the industry, but I remember being an employee at LucasArts back when George broke it to ILM that he could make more money investing in certificates of deposit than he was making from ILM. And I think he was doing it as a way to kind of push back a little bit on people clamoring for, you know, high tech salaries. But in any case, it's on the whole, it's true, right? I mean, I think, you know, and mostly because of salaries, as well as actual square footage overhead, this business is not one in which you know, it's traditional to make double digit profits.
Well, I'd add to that the cost of keeping up with the technology, right? Because that's the thing that broke many of PDIs back in the day. They were all investing in like Cray supercomputers, and they had to, you know, reinvest every few years, and they never paid off the first bunch. And I think PDI survived because it was buying workstations, and in the day before workstations were known to be such a good idea. And I would say that today it remains the same, that, you know, you're having to update the computers and update the render farms, and it's very capital intensive, and at some point that comes down to cost of capital.
Fair enough. I mean, I was prepared to dispute the point that it's still as much the case as it would have been 10 or 15 years ago, and it may not be. Would you agree?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, people say, well, computers get cheaper and cheaper, and they do. But I mean, you know, we didn't, back in the day, we never had, you know, 1,000, 4,000 render farms, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you've walked through ILM's render farm, it's like a lot of money, right? But I mean, you know, all of that should theoretically be secondary to the cost of getting good quality staff, or more to the point, how commoditized is the functions that the staff are doing? Which leads to a further point, which is how much is the process of very complicated effects able to be broken down into a series of smaller steps that are in of themselves not that hard and consequently easier to farm out and do, versus the old days where, you know, it was the group of a small number of sort of geniuses that all had to write code and do stuff themselves, and it wasn't like the whole task was broken down into something that, you know, 400 people tackled in a production line style environment.
Indeed not. Now, I mean, if you want to look at an industry that's gone down that road much more quickly from the garage operation with one or two guys really cleverly making code to an operation of a huge number of animators in Asia, I think 3D computer games is probably one place you can really see that that's happened, where there are companies here in the States that really no longer consider it viable to create 3D graphics in large for these big blockbuster games here. Now, we haven't seen that in visual effects, and it's worth asking why. One point seems to be just communication. Communication, obviously, face-to-face communication is enough of a challenge by itself, i.e. communicating with somebody sitting across the table from you about what needs to be done, or sitting with someone at their workstation. You know, we all know communication can even break down in that case, let alone trying to use various types of technology to run a studio halfway around the world. Now, it's worth noting that we pulled out this example of Rhythm and Hue's Mumbai as an example. That was not, and correct me if I'm wrong about this, but it was not set up quickly, and it's not even a true example of outsourcing in terms of, hey, let's open the phone book and see who's out there that can pick up some shots for us. I believe that it was a pretty concerted effort, actually, on RNH's part over several years to get that studio up and running. Mike, do you know a bit more about what?
Yeah,
RNH
set up not a cheap sweatshop in the Middle East that they would send stuff to and not care about. They set up a transparent half of or part of the company that just happens to be located in India. So when you come to Rhythm and Hue's offices in California, you know, work gets done in California, work gets done in Mumbai, and it's not immediately apparent where it is. And I should also point out that in respect for the artists that worked on the work at that was done for Golden Compass, that, I mean, you know, they contributed creatively enormously. Now,
yeah,
I mean, you alluded to this at the beginning, and here's the thing, right? Like, you know, if somebody says, well, I think it's outrageous that they did that work in India because I wish they'd done it here because we need those jobs at home, and you'd lost your job, then I'm like completely sympathetic to that. I just have, there's no comeback for that, right? Like, yeah, it really sucks if you lost your job. And by the same token, I would think it offensive to a Mumbai artist who really pulled it out to help win an Academy Award for visual effects to imply that Rhythm and Hue's India was just doing the crap work that RNH California didn't want to do, because that's also not true.
It isn't true. It did actually begin with them doing predominantly roto and kind of low-level comping, I believe. But by the end, I know they were doing some hero shots and characters. And in fact, there was pretty good profile actually on National Public Radio of all places that I happened to hear, where they played out, I don't think they re-dramatized it. It was the actual sort of triumphant day on which they finally nailed the look of the monkey, who was really a starring CG character. And it was the Mumbai office that really pulled it off. So, and at the same time, I think they were working on Alvin and the Chipmunks. They were really busy over there. Now, I spoke to people at RNH, a couple of folks who were willing to talk to me about it, and it wasn't at all as if work disappeared out of RNH LA. Quite the opposite. I think it basically allowed what was a kind of mid-sized studio to step up and do a really ambitious project. Would you agree with that, Mike?
Yeah, I mean, I think, it gets back to this thing. I think that the artists in the Mumbai office were working with the artists in the LA office. Now, I didn't have any involvement with the project, but I mean, you know, there's, 200 employees in the Mumbai office of RNH?
That's
and, yeah, and so, you know, it's like, it's this problem one has that it's incredibly emotional discussion point, this, right? Because I'm sure that people, you know, feel very, very strongly if they're in an area that they feel is being hit. But by the same token, you know, like, yeah, there's just nothing wrong with having a collection of artists working on a film from multiple companies, and in this case, multiple divisions in the same company. I mean, what film doesn't, you know, end up with CineSight doing some shots, ILM doing some shots, Orphanage doing some shots, you know, primarily effects are by Weta. I mean, that's just, you know, and here's the thing, right? Do we call Weta an outsourced company? I mean, do we call? I mean, is New Zealand stealing jobs from California? Are we outraged at what the English have done in pulling stuff? See, now I'm just saying this. I'm not trying to be inflammatory, but I'm just trying to offer a point of view because, you know, I have friends in India and China, decent, incredibly talented people. And it's like, is it, you know, be really careful here that we don't kind of get, I'm going to say this, but we don't want to, not aimed at you, of course, Mark, but one has to be careful that it isn't, you know, almost a racist thing to say, well, I'm upset about India and China. I'm not upset about London and New Zealand.
Agreed. It is, though, worth pointing out that, for example, China is well known for not purchasing software, by and large. And so there's often a suspicion when animation is done in China and shops here are trying to compete that the Chinese didn't actually pay for their software.
Okay, but I would argue with that by saying this. Yeah. That isn't the problem because the software costs a few $100, right? I mean, top of the line, you know, Shake, whatever, you know, Silhouette, Roto stuff. We're talking a few $100. The problem is, and I'm not saying it's a problem for anyone individually, but the problem is the salary difference. It's, you know, that the guy in China is earning, you know, $3,000-$5,000 a year, not, you know, $75,000 a year. And that completely swamps the software argument in terms of cash flow.
Yeah, it's also worth pointing out, it came up in our research that you can't even lump all of Asia together. In fact, India is also managing to undersell Korea and some other Asian countries that Japan, obviously, that have had a longer track record of doing computer graphics.
And, you know, here's the thing, like, I've been up in Korea and I went up there specifically. I mean, I was invited up and there was part of a program the Korean government were doing to improve their visual effects stuff. And I, you know, it was a conference and I happily went. And then we went down south to south of South Korea and there was a school there that just had, you know, classroom after classroom of immaculate, beautiful new Macs and PCs loaded up with the latest software that hundreds of students were about to walk in and start training behind. Now, I can see more point in arguing over government stuff than I can over individuals. Like, in other words, I'm very loath to criticize the individual that worked on Golden Compass in Mumbai over the artist in anywhere else because, you know, that doesn't seem fair. But I can understand that you could be upset that some governments are trying to dramatically pump money into an industry to specifically pull work to their country. And that seems tough if you're in a country who's in the firing line of that kind of government orchestrated and, you know, all legal, but, you know, government funded, government backed major pushes. But, and again, you know, it's you were talking about India in particular. I mean, India, like China, has lower salaries. I don't believe there's the same level of piracy in India. And certainly India seems to be pulling more work than China. But both of these countries, China and India, have enormous film markets in their own right. So there's nothing, yeah, there's nothing wrong with them making films. I mean, they make millions of them, right? And why not have a more developed film market in China and in India? I'm sure Chinese people love seeing really good visual effects films that are for a Chinese audience made by a Chinese film industry.
Yeah, it's interesting. I have in front of me a job listing that was posted at Tupop late last year from Technicolor Beijing. And they have opened a major visual effects house there. But it's really to cater to the Chinese film market, not actually to deal with outsourced work from U.S. studios. Now, it's worth noting in the India versus China discussion that people in India are quite good English speakers for the most part, especially the educated Indians who go into high technology. And that seems to be the common language of our industry. It's not uniformly true. And certainly we've all, well, I mean, work in a few studios and you certainly work with plenty of people who speak natively in something other than English. However, Mike, would you dispute the fact that most studios are speaking English as they work and they're serving, by and large, Hollywood, their clients are probably
Oh, natives. Totally. And I mean, I think India India has benefited enormously from that whole English education background back in to the days of the Raj. And heck, my grandfather was one of the governors or part of the governor's thing to Ceylon. So, you know, yeah, sure, right. Back in the day when the sun never set on the English Empire without asking permission first. But look, the thing is, you know, so as I said, so what? Like New Zealand speaks English. Well, I mean, you know, Australians and New Zealanders try and speak English. Americans even try and speak English. Like it is the language of the film industry, and certainly all the products and the applications tend to be predominantly in English for the buttons and stuff. I remember seeing people in Japan who taped on bits of tape to their monitor with the Japanese on top of the flame buttons because the buttons didn't move around on the screen, so that was possible for them to physically tape on top of the monitor the names of buttons. But other than that, you know, like you're really hard done by if you don't speak English and you try and use a flame somewhere else in the world. But I mean, here's the thing, right? Like, you've got an industry that is in a country that has seen enormous success in outsourcing in every other area. So, you know, phone centers, the obvious one, right? Call centers, all that kind of stuff. And much as you may hate getting a call from a call center in India, in that opening discussion, you mentioned that book, you know, about the world is flat. And yeah, you know, it makes a huge case in that when you've got an English speaking population that is predominantly at a lower cost level, and you add in the one thing we haven't mentioned yet, which is massive infrastructure of internet pipes, fiber optics and stuff, it's completely possible to outsource, and it shouldn't be surprising to anyone that that's what's going to happen. Now, as I say, that's at the corporate-y kind of big government-y economic level. But I mean, you know, you'd be nuts to think that if you were sitting in India looking at, you know, Western lifestyles, that you wouldn't say, well, we could do that and we can understand and, you know, we've got bright people here, so why don't we set up some companies to service some of that business? And they do, and they are obviously doing it successfully. The question you've got to ask yourself is that in of itself detrimental to the industry? It might be detrimental to the individual who's facing reduction in one area, but is it a bad thing for the effects industry to globalize?
Well, part of the reason for this show being is that we've just seen a great example of it being anything but detrimental. I mean, I don't know if Rhythm and Hues, I don't know if anyone has gone on record to say that, you know, the Mumbai studio was essential to them, you know, pulling that off. But we know that they were an essential part of the effort, and we know that they won the Academy Award. So there it is. Now, what kind of obstacles would a studio, say, in the U.S. face? But actually, maybe we should talk about your part of the world, too, because I've met people from places like Cape Town that are also interested in whether they could send work to, again, particularly India seems to be a place people think about. Now, what kind of obstacles would a studio face if they tried to do that, Mike?
Mark, you're a good friend, but I have to point out that thinking that Sydney is close to Cape Town is worse than calling a Canadian an American.
Well, they're both south of that line.
So, yeah, down the bottom part of that world there somewhere.
Yeah, exactly.
Wrong half of the world, but okay. Cripes. Oh, dear. No, actually, I'm broadcasting here from Austria. So what was the question? I'm sorry. I mean,
What obstacles would – I mean, what obstacles would any studio face? Obviously,
the big obstacles you face with outsourcing are reliability, communication, and funds. Okay, those are the three. So reliability, because you need to establish relationships and you need to know the quality of the work, and quantifying that from a remote location is difficult. Communication, both electronically and just verbally, like, you know, as you said before, the problems of speaking, but also just, you know, getting into China. China does not have broadband everywhere. I mean, there's an illusion that China has massive broadband, but it just doesn't. It's hard yakka to get stuff transferred in and out of China at speed. Unless you can dovetail off Hong Kong. There's only one link across the Pacific, by the way. You go the other way to India, there's a lot of links. And then the third thing that you have to worry about is actual funding, because, you know, people have wasted a lot of money trying to set up places in that you don't hear about that failed because they just, you know, put money into the wrong places and set it up in the wrong... So obviously it's much, much more advantageous to set up a local kind of co-venture with local people on the ground to make sure that you're not coming in. I mean, Technicolor, you gave an example of before, and I know a bit about that particular setup of that facility, and they were desperately trying to have local people as much as they were people from overseas. But I would say that would be the case with trying to set up something in Spain or Germany. I would want to have local people on the ground that were, you know, had an interest in it, and I wasn't just coming in as some kind of, in my case, Sydney-based company that was going to tell the Germans or the Spanish how to do their job. And so, but people do go into these countries and think that they're just going to be able to get a cheap workforce and just, you know, run it. And you need to be cognizant of the various cultural and, quite frankly, political issues in the individual countries.
Is there a question of which jobs are really the desirable ones and which ones are just subject to cost-benefit analysis and driving down the kind of price per hour? The reason I ask that, you know, one thing that has not happened, and I was alluding to this earlier with the technology shift just out of Silicon Valley, just over to Sacramento, you know, there are other places in the U.S. that have tried in various ways to set up a certain production capability, and some of them have succeeded more than others. Quite a few people have been shooting down in Albuquerque, New Mexico lately because of tax breaks that are being given there. So the U.S., parts of the U.S. are fighting back that battle against places like Vancouver these days. So it's not just one country versus another. It's actually can be one city versus another, and that's been going on for a long time in various industries. But I wonder if there are certain types of jobs that really, you know, it doesn't matter if you send them to Salt Lake City or wherever you can find, you know, North Dakota, really low overhead, it would be really hard to get people to fill them, even if they're jobs.
Is North Dakota not a very nice place? Every time we just one of these, it's North Dakota comes up. Is South Dakota really great and North Dakota sucks? I've not been to either Dakota.
Well, South Dakota was at least has some tech history because Gateway Computers, I think, was run out of there for a while. So they did try. But as far as I know, North Dakota has never really done much but shrink down to where it's mostly Native Americans living there these days. But maybe we'll hear from some North Dakotans who are going to
say. I'm not saying anything bad about any Dakotas. I'm just saying you guys keep on mentioning Dakotas as like, you know, it's like our Tasmania. I mean, you know, poor bastards. Hey, look, here's the thing, right? You're absolutely right. Like people have tried and they're doing it. Like there's a place called rotofactory.com. And rotofactory.com is a place that specializes in having, you know, stuff sent to it from, you know, companies like ILM, Tippett Studios, The Orphanage, you know, whatever, Cafe FX, whoever it is. And they do roto stuff, and it's an outsourcing roto pipeline. And it's called Rotofactory, right? Just happens to be in America.
Yeah, well, not only that, it happens to be within driving distance of most of their clients and run by people who are former employees of the companies that are sending a lot of the work. They're out in the wine country, so they did a pretty smart thing there, actually, don't you think?
Yeah, but that specialization of that job. Now, these guys seem to be successful. You probably know more about them than I do, but they must be competing with exactly this somewhere else in the world, right? Like, you know, another roto outfit that's fighting for that business in India, China, New Zealand, and Paris. And my point is that, you know, this idea of being able to break the job down and give out specialist stuff clearly applies both in and outside America. And I don't know that it's a bad thing that this is what happens when you commoditize and industrialize a process, that you set up specialist companies to do it. And then some of those specialist companies will be in America and some won't. But I mean, you know, I'm just so nervous about offending people, but you've got to ask. Like, it's just, I get back to where I was a few minutes ago, which is, you know, is that really that surprising? I mean, couldn't Rotofactory be in several other countries in the world almost as successfully, and or at least have half of its operation somewhere else?
All right. So Roto is often picked as the example of an easily outsourced operation. And in fact, it also happens to be one that most studios have trouble filling their seats, you know, especially when the need becomes acute, as it often does, as you know. Suddenly a show will come in and it turns out to have been shot in such a way that it just has a nightmarish amount of roto. And, you know, your typical in-house roto staff has got more than they can handle and not enough time to staff up. So it's a perfect case for calling up an already established facility. And, you know, Roto is, it does require artistic talent. It requires...
Oh, totally.
I mean, it requires a lot of the person doing it. And yet, it is the kind of thing that one can say is done in a way that is, you know, acceptable or not. At the end of the day, the result will basically be, if not 100% consistent between two people doing it right, at least within the same realm. Yes?
Yeah, look, I mean, absolutely. If you've ever tried doing stereoscopic rotoscoping, it's one of the most challenging areas, right? Like, it is insanely... Because if you get it wrong, people literally throw up in the audience.
Yeah, so, yeah, I've worked on people 3D films.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like, this is not... So we're not saying that roto is easy, but yeah, it's a containable part of a pipeline, a commoditized production pipeline that you can... therefore farm out. And so then the question is, well, are you surprised that it's farmed out? And the answer is no. I mean, I say these things, I'm speaking, you know, not to you specifically, but, you know, generally. And yeah, and then if it gets farmed out to this, to the wine country area, that seems like a nice place to be, but I'm sure it would be happily farmed out to other places as well. But it's because, as you say, it's much, much less open to creative interpretation. The director doesn't have to say, I want the roto to feel more empathetic to the underlying metaphor.
Mm-hmm. Now, what other areas of our production pipelines in VFX do we think?
Well, I mean, the obvious, I guess you'd add rig removal in as the first one, right? Right after rotoscoping, which is to say almost the same thing, but close.
Okay, how about 3D tracking?
I definitely think that 3D tracking has parts of it that are like that. Obviously, you could set up a pipeline where there's an enormous amount of 3D tracking done and every shot gets tracked. But then on the other occasions, of course, where the tracking is very specific to object tracking or, you know, trying to deal with objects in the track. But general 3D tracking is a candidate, again, because it doesn't tend to require artistic interpretation.
Do you think there's a danger, given that roto 3D tracking and a couple of other positions that might be more essential, like in-house IT support, have been entry-level jobs and actually really good apprenticeships for working in VFX companies. Is there a danger that those jobs would ever disappear completely, like facilities would just do without a roto or a match move department altogether?
I'm sure it's normally faster to do that in-house, but you bring an excellent point up, which is we are crushing the paths for access into these jobs by shutting down these entry-level positions. Or I shouldn't say that, because I really don't think that that, you know, roto is an entry-level only position, but obviously some people come in through roto.
Oh yeah, no, I mean, they're roto experts in the world,
yeah,
for sure.
I don't know, I guess I'm just torn, you know, like, I think it's really a shame that younger artists don't have a more flexible path in. But I'd also point to the fact that, now, this is speculation and not based on any research, but if you look at something like Pixar, right, Pixar does what I consider to be an enormous amount of work, a feature a year pretty much, and it doesn't have anywhere near as many staff as I certainly would have thought of. And they seem to be in a position where they're effectively leveraging a smaller number of staff through better IT support, more creative tools, and really exceptionally good talent, as opposed to trying to commoditize it out to be more of a production line with more bums on seats, but maybe each bum is less clever, if that makes sense. Does that make sense?
It does, and I mean, I'd go further. I mean, Pixar is really living the dream as far as a lot of houses are concerned, not only creatively, but, you know, in terms of margin. I mean, they really are doing much better business. I mean, it's a publicly traded company, which they're not the only one, but they, not only that, but their stock has really taken off, despite that they only make one film a year, which, if you think about it, is a really risky business proposition. I mean, all of your business is based around kind of one event each year. Most people would not want to invest in a business like that, despite all the ancillary revenue and what a machine, you know, marketing machine Disney is and so on. I mean, we've seen Disney get tripped up in their own films to where, you know, those are now Pixar films being done at Disney.
There was a really great discussion of this on a mailing list called the DLF, which I think is worth bearing to think about. If you look at, and I mean, this is really simplistic, okay? I mean, before everyone emails and points that out, I understand it is completely simplistic. But, you know, you take the budget of a Pixar film and that's, you know, a lot of money, right? Like it's, I don't know, 150 million or something, and divided by the number of minutes that the film is, which is, say, in the case of Ratatouille, about 111 minutes, and you get to $1.3 million a minute to make a Pixar film, right? And then now, of course, you know, we're leaving out all of the money they make from everything else, from every other form of revenue, right? And, but we're just talking about this is what it costs theoretically to make the film, and that works out at $21,000 a second. Well, I don't know about you, but in this market, we're talking about normal TVC stuff as being closer to like about, I don't know, $1,200 a second. So, and even at normal kind of animation rates, you know, you're probably talking around 2 to 10K a second of finished material. So, you know, they make high quality work and they basically built a production pipeline that pays for high quality work and does it at a phenomenally high cost per second, and then they go out and gross hundreds of millions of dollars on every single film. And I guess my point in bringing this up is to say that it isn't all about low cost. Like, this discussion is centered around offshoring on the basis of saving money, right? Pixar's not trying to save money, they're just making it.
Indeed. You know, I think it's also worth keeping in mind in terms of running a doing ambitious work with a small staff. You know, more and more processes get automated over time, and there are other industries that have gone well down this road. If you look at the way music for films used to be done, you know, where it required dozens of people to put together a soundtrack of a film, whereas, you know, now it's, I mean, there's a precedent for one person doing an entire film soundtrack, and that was really bad news for a lot of session musicians for a while. But it also gave a much better opportunity to the players who really could compose and actually, you know, create.
Yeah, get a really good emotional response. Yeah.
Yeah.
So my point is, right, that sort of an extra layer on this that I think we ought to keep an eye on is, let's talk about stereoscopic rotoscoping, because, you know, hey, I brought it up. Right now, we know that there are people working on automated stereoscopic rotoscoping tools, right? So if you go building an outsourcing business on doing precision rotoscoping and someone automates that process, then you're going to get clobbered, right? And yep. Anything that's unitizable, if that's a real word, that's commoditizable, that you can break down to a sort of simply non-artistically contributed task is also totally viable for computerization. And so, you know, while we're feeling bad about some of these jobs going overseas, some of these jobs are going to go from overseas back to companies that just invest in the technology. And, you know, Lord only knows, places like ILM have come up with amazing technological leaps over the years that seem to have suddenly, you know, ripped, you know, days or weeks out of what was a pretty hard task to do.
Yeah, and, you know, getting back to the psychology of this, I also have run into so many cases where people in our field, A, have that basic artist insecurity where, you know, you think, oh, God, they're going to find out I don't really know what I'm doing. And B, you actually, you know, many people have a hard time quantifying exactly how their day goes or remembering, you know, how many thousands of steps went into creating a shot. It can be really hard to remember, you know, how many individual decisions go into that. And so I think there's a fear that all the jobs could be done by a machine at some point. And, you know, obviously we're a long way from that. You know, as a last thing, I wanted to look at the kind of myth that's behind this that a lot of us carry around, and there may be some truth to it, but it's the idea that I could be anywhere doing this work. You look at, you know, I'm sitting here recording the show on a MacBook Pro, and I, you know, sure, I mean, a lot of the things I work on are under non-disclosure, and you know, I have to have a card key to just get into the building, and no shots leave. Other things, and even those things, if they didn't, they weren't subject to that kind of secrecy, you know, I feel like, well, I could load it up on this machine here, and you know, it's not going to be as fast as my desktop machine, but it's quite a bit faster than some of the machines I see used in facilities here and there. And you know, I could bang out the shot wherever, Tahiti, down at the coffee shop on the corner, anywhere that's got electricity and a way for me to send the result back. And yet, somehow that doesn't seem to happen. Would you agree?
Well, no, absolutely not. Are you nuts? I'm like co-founder of a distributed company that has people in like six continents working constantly to put out 30, you know, things a week. Like,
right. Okay, but so why doesn't it? It doesn't. But does it happen with feature films?
There are some areas like matte painting and stuff that totally happens in. And there are some areas that it just need face-to-face contact. And I would kill to be in a John Lasseter script through reading, you know, actually in the room when Lasseter reads the storyboards and acts it out kind of in front with a, with a pen and a, you know, paper hat in his head. And nothing would, you know, no amount of video conferencing or anything else is going to, you know, what it would be like to be in that, you know, room when he does that. So, I mean, some stuff doesn't work well. And we at FXPHD get together and we're going to do it in NAB and we do a lot of face-to-face contacting stuff. But if you have the contacts, and this is a pivotal point, like you and I have sat in restaurants in San Francisco, right, and know each other, right? And so if you send me an email and says, you know, blah, I don't like this, I like go, well, that's Mark. I like Mark. I know Mark's a good guy. Mark doesn't mean that, you know, I'm a jerk and I'm just reading it wrongly because of the dialogue of an American speaking the English language. And, you know, I just cut you huge amounts of slack because you and I have sat together in restaurants in San Francisco. My point being that if you were the guys you know, that was splitting from a company that knew all these people, yeah, you could work remotely because if you knew them, then they'd have the contacts and you can do stuff on the phone and it would be cool because we all knew each other for FXPHD before we started doing it. What I think's killer hard is to break into that. What I think's killer hard is to pitch, I'm going to set up a new company that's going to do distributed production. And with people I've never met, we're all going to work together and get along and not assume that people hate each other and they're being rude. Because you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah, like, you're making several excellent points, actually.
And so we live the dream of the distributed company. Hell, you know, I mean, there are three people around me right now in my office, but that's a fraction of the people that are working on PhD, and we work 24/7. And we're not stealing jobs from anyone because we're you know, creating them. But I'm not being defensive. I'm just saying, like, but it works because at the end of the day, I know John Montgomery and Jeff and the guys really, really well. And I read their, I can hear them speaking when I read their emails, right? I think that the obstacle to get over is if you don't have those relationships, forging them. And I imagine that that is why companies do succeed well in outsourcing when they have people locally based that, like in the case of Rhythm and Hughes, I'm sure are moving back and forth between the LA office and the Mumbai office and people know each other. And I know when when Lucas was setting up the Singapore office of Lucasfilm, that I think at that time Rob Coleman was spending a lot of time out in Singapore setting stuff up. And, you know, part of that reason is once you get to know people, then you can do the distributed stuff. Now, on a big project, how feasible is that to do? I mean, how feasible is it to have, you know, 50, 60, 70 people distributed, 150 people distributed? I think you'd end up with clusters distributed with people at each location that kind of knew. And you'd want to spend a bunch of money on getting them together every once in a while just to play, what do you call it, softball? No, baseball. Yeah. Because, you know, it's whatever that weird thing is that you guys do. You know, any sport that doesn't stop for a cup of tea isn't my kind of sport. But you know what I'm saying, right? Like, if you would want to invest in that contact time so that for the rest of the time when they weren't in front of each other. Because I'm sure in a normal office, when you're at a major facility, Mark, you're not necessarily interacting with everyone face-to-face. You spend a lot of time emailing people in your own company, right? Mm-hmm. It's just that you need some amount of face contact to know that, here, he's a good guy, he's trusted, and yeah. And if you
and to make up for the misunderstandings that occur via
totally.
Email.
Totally. And if you sent me an email saying I didn't like this shot because I thought it sucked here, if I know it's Mark Christensen, I respect your opinion. So it's like it just cuts completely differently to who is this guy that's claiming that my shot's not very good. You know what?
Well,
you
and we all know people, particularly some of the more technical people in our industry, who have a way of being a bit curt in their email styles.
Yeah, crushingly so. My thing.
So, I mean, to just step back from the points you're making, I mean, what you're saying, first of all, is that, you know, this work is cultural and collaborative in a way that we all do it because it is. There are other types of work we could probably choose to do that would let us be more solitary. And sometimes people do prefer that. And, you know, there are matte painters and coders who get to do that. And they are the ones who end up in maybe in coffee shops or up in strange little towns in eastern Washington doing their thing. You're also saying, you know, there's just a value of face-to-face somewhere in the process, and preferably, you know, nearer the beginning before misunderstandings start to occur, as they inevitably will in the heat of battle. So there's a establishing a relationship that's a, you know, obviously a very ancient human process.
I mean, it's probably, as you say, I mean, God, I'm really sticking my neck out here and sound like a complete wanker, but it's probably tribal. Do you know what I mean? If you think that our tribe is together and my part of the tribe is over here and the other part of my tribe is over there, we're cool. But if my tribe is warring with your tribe, now we're not cool. And so I think you need to make it, or to use an American kind of football-y thing, they have to be on the same team. And, you know.
Indeed. Well, and not only that, I mean, when I say that the work is cultural, what I've noticed is there are people who will, myself included, who will rise to the level or the challenge of a job, given that, you know, that's what's going on that job, just as a football team does, right? I mean, everybody pulls together and, you know, you pull things off as an individual, but as part of that team that, you know, you on your own hadn't even really imagined. And that does seem to occur. You know, there's all kinds of forces behind it. I mean, there's peer pressure as well as encouragement, you know, maybe more so. But there is basically the whole awareness of what's happening and the way that you kind of, you know, get hip to that. And for example, you know, Pixar is the last place I could ever imagine. Even, you know, I think they'd be loath to even open an office across the street if they ran out of room. In fact, I think they ran into a situation like that, and it was a real dilemma because of how much that synergy is kind of, you know, crucial to what they're doing.
Yeah, totally. And I think that, I mean, there's all sorts of things about Pixar. We love Pixar. But I mean, like even in, internally, they've got a whole left and right brain on the way the building's built. But yep. Both sides have to go to the same mailroom and have to eat in the same area so that those two sides, because it's this whole thing about the offensive and the defensive team being the same team, right? Did you like that football reference?
Yeah,
that was
very
that
good.
Was for Jen, my Chicago's best.
Couldn't say that about cricket.
No, but I don't have a. But that would be the bowling and the batting team, both feeling like the same team. But anyway, my point is though, you've got to feel like you're on the same team first, and then we're doing different stuff, and that's the pivotal point, I think. And God, I would hate to be in a company where it became territorial, and you had, you know, the LA office warring with the New York office, or for that matter, the Sydney office warring with the Mumbai office. Because that
well, that's simply not. I mean, in the example, you know, in the R&H example, that's simply not what happened. Now, whether other studios are going to take the trouble to build an operation like they did remains to be seen. Do you see any evidence of, you know, any other studios going to that extent?
Totally. I mean, I think, God, I hope I'm not breaking any NDAs. I think there's quite a few of the big Hollywood effects houses that if they haven't already opened them, are opening them. I say that because we advise some recruiters, but
That's because Australia's right next to India, right?
Yeah, right. Just right next door. Yeah, sure. Yeah. Just... Yep,
south of the equator.
Yeah, right. No, it's almost next door to each other. The Cape Town's in the middle.
Oh, right. Yeah, good. So you stop by there for tea while you're playing cricket. Okay, go ahead.
I have nothing. I'm done.
All right.
No, well, that, clearly this is some kind of American taunting that you guys do in the American office of this program that we just don't do here in the Sydney office of this program.
And there you have it, folks. Outsourcing and globalization in action. Well, we've kicked this run around, and we could probably do an entire series. And, you know, I'm sure the topic will come back. We may even have an opportunity to talk on the show with individuals actually working in some of these places. And if you have more light you can shed for us, please do so. Mike, do you have anything you want to tell everybody about before we take off?
Not really. Are you going to make it to NAB?
I am now, actually. Yes, I'm speaking in the booth at Artbeats, so I'm going to be doing some demos using some of their stock footage. They've got some cool stuff. I haven't even chosen which of their HD plates I'm going to use, but they've been doing a bunch of really cool high speed photography lately.
Oh, yeah. I like Artbeats. They're nice people.
Yeah, they are. And you'll be there. The whole PhD crew is going to be
and you guys going to... Actually, I will plug one thing because I genuinely think it's worth plugging, which is if you go over to FX Guide at the moment, we've got our I mentioned it last week on the show, so it's not really clever to plug it twice, but we've just published The Art of Digital Stereoscopic Workflow. So we publish these Art of ones every once in a while. They nearly kill me every time I write them. And, well, I should say I write them. We write them. It's a team effort. The guys do a huge amount of work trying to make head or tail of my notes. But, so we basically looked into 3D stereoscopic imaging and tried to make head or tail of it from production all the way through to distribution and projection. And it's a hot topic, and we enjoy writing these, and I'm kind of proud of it. So if you're interested in finding out about that stuff, check it out at fxguide.com.
I'm going to head over there right now.
Yeah, it's you know, I kind of love researching stuff. I got to say, it's one of the joys of our job is just researching a topic. And I was so many people were so helpful in putting that story together. And it's a good industry, our industry. People are just genuinely really good at sharing their knowledge and helping stuff out. So it was cool. Hey, and I know Alex has also done lecturing and stuff in India. With, I believe, one of the chip manufacturers. He sends his apologies. Alex is tied up. He has a new child, as many of you know. And so he hasn't been appearing, but only for reasons of scheduling, not for reasons of anything else. And he sends his apologies. And we hope that we can nail him soon for a show and or at NAB. But yes, if you're wondering where Alex is, that's the reason.
Yeah, I was sorry that he couldn't be with us for this show. This is right up his alley, actually.
Yes, I imagine he'd be arguing with me over a few points. And he gets, well, you know, that's the price you pay for not turning up. Decisions are made by those that turn up.
Well, he can send us an email.
Yeah, totally. What are you talking about?
All right. All right, well, thank you, Mike.
It's been a pleasure. You should host more often.
Okay. I'm getting a little more used to it. Thank you. All right. So... that's it from us, and we'll see you next week when we'll be back to movie review. I'm not going to say which one because we've been a little unpredictable at our end over what's next, but we'll see you then.